Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let's talk Western Conference playoffs in the NBA. Yesterday was a rough day for the NBA underdogs. In fact, it was the day that they were put to bed, taken to the woodshed. Golden State 118, New Orleans 92, Houston 100, Utah 87. We're now one game away from the series that everybody's been looking forward to the entire season, Golden State, Houston. I mean, we're so close, we can almost start breaking down that matchup. Both teams are up 3-1. Both series are over. Well, actually, one of them is not over. It's still alive. That is, if you ask Chris Paul.
From your first ever appearance in a conference final, have you allowed your mind to go that far yet?
Nah, it's the process, man. I've been here before, 3-1. Bad real quick. You know what I mean? So.
Well, he's right about that. Bleep did go bad real quick with the Clippers up 3-1. But these Rockets are not those Clippers. And these Warriors are most definitely not those Clippers. The Pelicans smashed Golden State up in game 3, and that served as a wake-up call. Well, actually, Draymond Green was not able to sleep after that game, so he sent Kevin Durant what he referred to as a long-ass text message. And while Draymond would not say what was in that text, he did tell ESPN, quote, "I just challenged him to be who he is. I had to tell him I didn't see him attacking or being aggressive enough on both ends of the floor like we need him to be. You know, I don't hold back. When I see something's wrong, I have to voice my opinion. There were no hard feelings. We're just trying to win a ball game," end quote. So Durant rolls out. He wakes up to that text and he replies, quote, "I got you. I got you." And then he went out and he got him and he got the Pelicans for 38-9. Vintage Kevin Durant performance. Mid-range game on point. Perfect from the line, and he mixed in a couple of threes. Those are the games where Golden State reminds you who they really are. That team when it plays like that, can't lose. Nobody beats that team. Not Houston, and not even the Cavaliers with killer LeBron. When Golden State plays like that, when Golden State's right, they're unbeatable. And right now, they're right. Especially when Andre Iguodala starts and instead of the death lineup, they go with the Hamptons 5 lineup. Even if Steve Kerr feels weird and thinks that nickname is a little bit lame.
I still am amused that we just matter-of-factly call them the Hamptons 5. I know that's Tim. Yeah, well, Tim Kawakami deserves all the credit then. I just feel strange, like, as a coach saying, "Well, the Hamptons 5 played really well tonight." Like, I can't say that, but you can.
I can, and I will, coach, because I think the Hamptons 5 is a great nickname, and it's a scary lineup. And that crew is not looking to talk hedge funds or polo or which private schools their kids get into. They're looking to destroy you and snatch your soul. And I'm not going to bore you with any of the analytics. I'll just read the names of that starting lineup, and you can do the math. Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, Andre Iguodala. They carve you on offense. They choke you out on defense. There was nothing New Orleans could do. They had a great season. They had a great game 3. But when you run into that buzzsaw, it's over. Just like it was over last night in Utah when Houston dropped 30 in the first quarter and they took a 15-point lead in the second. You go into Salt Lake City and not only win game 3 by 21, but then you come back and you stomp on the Jazz from the very jump in game 4. That says something. In fact, it says a lot. It says the Rockets are really, really good and that the Jazz are simply overmatched and just too banged up. No Ricky Rubio, and then one player after another getting busted up in the game. Royce O'Neal, Dante Exum. It seemed like every time you turned around, another Utah player hit the deck. But they kept on battling and grinding and fighting and brawling and giving it everything they had, including this from Rudy Gobert.
Out to Crowder. Open triple. Gobert! Sacre bleu!
Finally, Gobert fighting on the offensive glass.
Thanks to TNT, but mostly thanks to Kevin Harlan. Sacre bleu! Suit allure! Avant-garde! Carte blanche! Vis-a-vis! Sacre bleu! Yeah, unfortunately, Utah's season just reached a cul-de-sac. Hey-o! This is the end. As good as they are, as tough as they are, they're not winning the next three. Just like New Orleans, good as they are, tough as they are, they're not winning the next three. So now we're a few days away from the showdown. Golden State v. Houston, Harden and Paul v. the Hamptons 5. We've been waiting all season long for it, and we're about to finally get what we all want. Every move Houston has made has been made with this challenge in mind. Now we'll see if they're up to it. Who you got? Normally I would say a 3-1 series is not over and anything can happen, but that's not true here. The Jazz and the Pelicans can't win. They're DOA. Those series are over. Who you got? Warriors or Rockets? My guest is Chris Mannix. Chris, what's going on, brother? How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How you doing, man?
Man, I'm great. It's great to have you back, Chris. Thanks so much. Let me start with the Celtics. They beat Philadelphia in overtime, Chris, on Saturday. They take a 3-0 series lead. These guys are one win away from the conference finals after losing their two biggest stars for the season. How do you explain how they're doing what they're doing?
You know, it's difficult, and you can even include a guy like Daniel Theis in that mix because he was such a valuable role player for them, and he went out at midseason. What they're doing is having young guys play well above their heads. And, you know, one of the reasons for that, and I think the biggest reason for that actually, is because these guys, when they were thrust into more prominent roles, they were ready for them. And a lot of that comes off the regular season, right? I mean, one of the strengths of Brad Stevens, and it doesn't get talked about a lot, but one of the strengths of Brad Stevens is that he gives young players a long leash when they're out there on the floor. You know, if they miss, if a Tatum or a Brown misses 3, 4, 5 shots in a row, Brad Stevens is not going to pull them out of the game. They know this, and it's given them confidence to play bigger roles when they've been called around on. So there's a lot of reasons why this series is 3-0 right now, but I think that's a pretty big one. The confidence been instilled in these young players early.
Chris Mannix, my guest. All right, so you've got the young players, and they've got that kind of confidence, and they know they're not going to get jerked off the floor if they miss a shot or two. And then you've got a vet like Al Horford. They win the game on that out-of-bounds play with 8.4 seconds left. Chris, first off, what did you make of that out-of-bounds play?
I mean, what a play. It's all I can think of. You know, I had a chance to talk to Kobe Bryant about this over the weekend, and you know, he brought it up immediately that he just could only laugh after watching that play. The anticipation of Brad Stevens to know that the Sixers were going to be overly aggressive on that play, to know that Embiid was going to switch out and Horford was going to be left alone with Embiid around the mid-court line on Robert Covington. I mean, that is just a special basketball mind at work down there. Give Horford credit. I mean, he's been the one constant for this team throughout all the changes. His leadership, you know, staffers and players alike will tell you, has been invaluable. But that play will go down as one of the best plays called of this year playoffs.
Chris Mannix joining us. I'm going to go back to Al Horford in a minute, but you posed a really interesting question on Twitter. Quote, you are the GM of an expansion team. You have your choice of any NBA player or Brad Stevens. Who do you choose? I mean, Chris, the fact that that would even be a question in and of itself is amazing, but how strong is the argument for picking Stevens?
I think it's pretty strong. And, you know, of course, Twitter being what it is, it didn't generate the most kind reactions
sure.
out there. But, you know, I'll tell you this much. I do a radio show on the weekends with Caron Butler. He told me he would take Brad Stevens over any player in the NBA. I heard from, after I posted it, a current GM and a former GM, and both of them told me they would take Brad Stevens. So it's a small sample size, but you're hearing from people that are involved with the game, that know the game better than I do, that say they take Brad Stevens. Now, one of the arguments that's often against a question like that, people don't remember, I say expansion team. I'm not talking about a team for one season. That would eliminate LeBron, who's in his mid-30s, from that mix. You want a young guy like an Embiid or a Giannis or somebody like that. But having a coach who can be on your sidelines for the next 10 to 15 years, I think that's just as valuable as having a star player for an expansion franchise.
I think it's a fair point, and I think it's a fair question. Now, the thing that's kind of hard to figure out, a lot of successful college coaches have had a really tough time making the transition to the NBA. Stevens, Chris, is not just good in the NBA. He's already one of the best coaches in the NBA. So what is it that makes this guy so different and so special?
It's just his mind at work. Now, look, he's everything you would expect in a quality coach. He's a film rat. He's able to see things on film, I think, that a lot of other coaches don't see. And that understanding of tendencies is invaluable, especially in late game type of situations. But, you know, the basics are there. The fact that he understands this is a players' league, the fact that he understands that, you know, what it takes to talk to today's players, which I think is a challenge a lot of coaches encounter when they come into the pro ranks.
It's Monday, and I've got a question for you, especially coming off the weekend. Whatever your diet, whatever your needs, Thrive Market has you covered. Best of all, instead of going to the store, you can stay home tonight and watch the four, yes, four elimination playoff games. Thrive Market is stocked with thousands of the best-selling non-GMO foods and natural products, always at 25 to 50% below traditional retail prices. They've got everything you need, whether your diet is paleo, gluten-free, vegan, kosher, plus personal care products, eco-friendly cleaning supplies, safe and non-toxic beauty products, organic baby food, kids products, and so much more. Click on a product and you'll see things like why you'll love it, price comparisons to retail, nutritional information, and more. You can shop knowing that you are getting the very best ingredients, the most affordable prices, and it's all safe for your family. Thrive Market's prices are already up to 50% off. And now they're giving you an extra $60 in free groceries plus free shipping. Get $60 of free organic groceries plus free shipping and a 30-day trial. Go to thrivemarket.com/Rome. Stock the pantry from your couch. Save time, save money. Go to thrivemarket.com/Rome right now. Chris Mannix talking NBA with us. We'll get some boxing in too before he goes. Let me ask you about Philadelphia. They run right through Miami, but things have not gone so well in this series, especially for Ben Simmons. What is the next step then for Simmons and Philadelphia?
I'm surprised by that, because I thought Miami was going to be the team that exposed Simmons, right? I mean, I thought Miami was, you know, extremely well coached, experienced on some level, tough, played good defense, but for whatever reason, you know, the Miami game plan wasn't as effective as Boston's game plan. If you're Ben Simmons, maybe your only priority this summer is your jump shot. And I go back to the conversation we had with Kobe this weekend, where, you know, Kobe basically said, you know, when I look at it, you just gotta start anew. You gotta break it down and do it all over again. That, I would tell you, Jim, that's a tough thing for a young player to do. When you're a young player like Ben Simmons, you've basically been the best player on the floor everywhere you've gone, every level. To be told that you have to fundamentally change your jump shot, that's not easy to do. Now, when it happens, it can work out. I mean, Kawhi Leonard is a great example of a guy that trusted the Spurs, trusted Chip England, changed his jump shot, and he became one of the best shooters in the league. Ben Simmons is going to have to do the exact same thing, because he can't take his game to that next level unless he's a threat from 18 feet and beyond.
Chris, speaking of Kawhi Leonard, anything new there? You talk about he trusted the Spurs. Does he still trust the Spurs? And what do you think that's going to happen, and how is that going to play out going forward?
No, and look, I'll be honest, I haven't checked in over a week on that situation, but I don't think that they've had the sit-down that they're going to have at some point. There are a lot of decisions that need to be made. I mean, it's Kawhi and it's Pop. You know, they got to talk. It's the doctors. I mean, the only way Kawhi's staying long-term is if they give him the 5 years Supermax type of deal. That's a risk for a small market team like San Antonio with a guy who's battling through an injury that cost him most of the season. So the next 2 months are going to be really critical for that franchise.
Chris Mannix for a few more moments. All right, Chris, we saw the game winner LeBron does it to Toronto again. At this point, are you able to just enjoy LeBron for what he's doing right now, or does every game feel like it's got to be some sort of referendum on whether or not he's the greatest player of all time?
No, I try not to make that referendum, mostly because I don't care. Like, I just, you know, the social media stuff pops up, like, he's the GOAT, he's this. I mean, it doesn't, you know, that's an argument for when LeBron's done. Well, let's see how many championships he wins. Let's see how many finals he goes to. Let's see where he finishes his career. I mean, that's a big part of it as well. I can enjoy him. And I would argue, Jim, that this playoff run is just as impressive as the playoff run back in 2007. I mean, in 2007, he had a weak team as well, but he did have a guy, Larry Hughes, who could make some shots. He had a few shot makers on that team. This year, I know Kevin Love has played really well the last few games, but it's been a LeBron show all throughout, and he just hasn't been able to trust his supporting cast at all during this postseason. So if this team gets back to the finals, and I don't know how you look at them and not make them a favorite at this point, I think it'll be LeBron's most impressive finals trip to date.
We're talking to Chris Mannix. All right, so what about Golden State and Houston? I don't want to jump the gun on that, but it looks pretty likely after the way they both played yesterday. They both have 3-1 series leads. What are your early thoughts on that potential matchup?
Well, I mean, is the way Clint Capella is playing, is that sustainable against Golden State? I mean, that's a big wild card. Clint Capella, on the same floor as Rudy Gobert, has at times looked like the best defensive player on the floor. And, you know, watching him out there just fly around the gym – you know, blocking mid-range jump shots, defending on the perimeter, defending the pick and roll at a high level. That's the wild card in all this. Both these teams will be able to score on each other, and both these teams will, the stars, I think, are going to play particularly well. But there are wild cards on both teams, whether it's Draymond, his three-point shooting. And for Houston, if Clint Capella plays this way in the conference finals, you know, I give them a great shot to win it.
All right, can't let you go without one final thought. Can't let you go, Chris, without a boxing question. After the way Triple G dominated Saturday night, how likely is it that we're finally going to get the Golovkin-Canelo rematch?
I think it's unlikely in September. I do. You know, look, I pressed Tom Loeffler, the promoter for this, when I had him on my boxing podcast recently. And look, if they wanted this fight, the same deal point should apply, right? I mean, for the most part, I mean, they had a deal. It just got scuttled when Canelo tested positive. That tells me that there's real strong indications from Triple G's camp that he's not willing to accept the same deal. And we know Canelo can be difficult to deal with anyway. So if I had to guess, I think both these guys fight somebody in the fall and we reconvene early 2019.
Did you get up to anything interesting? Because LeBron James did. He killed an entire city. Again. Look, I know at this point, we've seen everything there is to see, and nothing is supposed to impress anybody anymore. But what LeBron James is doing is still really impressive. In fact, beyond impressive. What he's doing to the city of Toronto, though, is beyond obscene. It's unfair. It's stupid. It's simply criminal.
6 seconds to go. Here comes LeBron. We're tied at 103. LeBron into the forecourt. In on Ananobi. Gets shoved toward the side. Banks it up. Oh, he did it again. LeBron James kissed it high off the window and drops it through. The LeBron James legend continues as LeBron James has won game three for the Cavaliers. Oh, goodness.
Thanks to Cavs Radio. This guy drives the length of the court, tosses up a floater, and nails it. And the thing is, he just did it so casually, like effortlessly. That looked like a dad playing against five-year-olds in the driveway. Not an NBA player against five other NBA players in Game 3 of the playoffs. I mean, I don't know how many times that I've watched that shot, and I still can't wrap my head around it. One-handed, off the glass, drifting towards the baseline, and he made it look so easy. It's so casual that even in real time, it looks like he was doing it in slow motion. And again, he had to go the length of the floor in order to do it. So let me recap the series quickly. LeBron and Cleveland trailed all of Game 1, then they rip it in OT. They blew out Toronto in Game 2. They did that in Game 3. Three games, three ways of wrecking and tormenting the Raptors. And this latest one might have been the worst because you knew exactly what was going to happen from the very moment he got that ball. Everybody knew what was going to happen, and he still did it, and he still made it look so easy. Now, LeBron, for his part, says it looked easy because he's been taking shots like that his entire life.
I've been doing that since I was like 6, 7, 8 years old, maybe even before that. It's a picture floating around of me besides a little Tykes hoop with a saggy pamper on. And I probably was doing it back then, all the way up until now, being, you know, 33.
I mean, didn't we all do that as kids? We didn't all end up there. So if LeBron's going to make it seem pretty casual, like it's no big thing, let's go ahead and ask other NBA players what they thought of that shot. Dirk tweeted, "Tough shot, makes it look easy." D'Angelo Russell tweeted, "We really witnessing history." And the Raptors official account just tweeted a screen full of angry emojis. Hey, look, I get it. I'd be doing the same thing if I were the Raptors also. Toronto threw everything they had at Cleveland in that final quarter. They battled, they brawled, they tied it up, and then LeBron did that to them. And even worse, he did it right in front of their bench. They're going to have this playing in their heads for a long, long time. In fact, pretty much forever.
6 seconds to go. Here comes LeBron. We're tied at 103. LeBron into the forecourt. In on Ananobi. Gets shoved toward the side. Banks it up. He did it again. LeBron James kissed it high off the window and drops it through. The LeBron James legend continues as LeBron James has won game three for the Cavaliers. Oh, goodness.
Oh, he's right. This is why I'm calling on the NBA to just cancel Game 4. Not because the series is over, because it is, but because LeBron has hurt the Raptors and the city of Toronto enough. I mean, how much punishment can one team and one city take? It's too much. It's gone too far. Pull this guy off them, the team, and the town. If you work on a hot, dusty job site or in a loud, wet kitchen, you know how hard it can be to communicate clearly. But now, with new Post-it Extreme Notes, you can get your message across and get the job done in any weather condition. That includes rain, heat, and even extreme humidity. New Post-it Extreme Notes are water resistant. They're made with DuraHold paper and adhesive, so they will stick to almost anything at all. Concrete, drywall, raw wood, and even brick. So no matter what the task on the job site requires, you can get your message across with new Post-it Extreme Notes. Even as the weather outside is heating up, Post-it Extreme Notes will stick on rough surfaces in the toughest weather conditions. Just because it's raining outside someplace else does not mean that work stops on the job site. With new water-resistant Post-it Extreme Notes, your message will stick on rough surfaces in tough weather conditions. New Post-it Extreme Notes. Buy them today wherever you get your Post-it notes. Now, I completely respect the Raptors. I know they'll give it everything they have in Game 4. Whatever they have left in the tank. They'll pour it out. I just don't know what's left in the tank. How could there be anything left after LeBron has done this to them time and time and time again? I'm not saying the Raptors should quit. I know they never would. Dwayne Casey, Kyle Lowry, who balled out. DeMar DeRozan and the rest of that crew, they're all way too proud to just pack it in, melt down, roll over. But I wouldn't blame them if they did. I wouldn't blame them if they held a vote in the locker room before that game and said, "Now we're good. We're good. We don't need to go through this again. Let's head back to Toronto and see if Brad Stevens can do something about this LeBron James situation." I wouldn't blame them at all if they did that, but they won't. They'll show up, they'll give it everything they have. And if history is any sort of guide, LeBron's going to find a new and different way to stab them in the heart, carve it out of their chest, and then make them eat it. Because that's what he does. And he does it to Toronto more than anybody else. Losing is one thing, losing to this guy the way they do over and over again is something totally different. And I'm not sure that I'm man enough to watch it happen again. And I don't even have a dog in this fight.
Oh, goodness.
I like Toronto. I don't want to see it happen to them again. And based on history and based on what I've seen, I don't see how they prevent it. They knew he was going to get it. They knew what he was going to do with it once he got it, and it still didn't matter. So what's to prevent that from happening again? We are now joined by Tony Loughman. Tony, what's going on, man? Good morning. How are you?
Fantastic, Rome. Best intro ever. I am in tears. That was so good.
Well, dude, you might be the best guest ever, and I might be in tears soon. You earned it. Tony Loughman joining us. All right, Tony, before we get to Game 6 of Nashville-Winnipeg, I've got to start with the topic that has been the topic of nearly every hockey conversation that I've had all year long, the Vegas Golden Knights. With every step, Tony, that they've taken this year, there's this air of, is this really happening? But now they're in the Western Conference Finals. Is it time to stop asking, is this really happening? And start saying, damn, these guys are good. Really, really good.
Yes, very well said. And that's the one thing I keep hearing from the guys that I sit next to, former coaches, former players, former general managers. In the beginning, what you're saying is 100% true. People were like, are they for real? Can this be sustained? The answer is yes, they're for real. Yes, they're incredibly successful for an inaugural season team, unprecedented, really. But the one thing I kept hearing as the playoffs have moved along is how great Marc-Andre Fleury's been. Their goalie has 4 shutouts in their 8 wins to this point. He's got to be among the favorites, if not the favorite, for the Conn Smythe. And Mike Rupp, who played alongside him in Pittsburgh earlier in his career, said, it's the best he's ever seen him play. And that's saying something for a guy who's won 3 cup rings already.
All right, so when you've got a guy like Fleury, and then you've got a bunch of guys on that team with a chip on their shoulders, does it feel then like a team that can win the whole thing?
Absolutely, 100% yes. The one thing that people keep saying around our office is, what's going to stop them? They roll 4 lines, they've got tremendous depth. In their 8 wins, 7 different guys have scored the game-winning goal. Gerard Gallant knows what he's doing. He's a veteran coach. He's experienced. Really, the most surprising thing about all of this is that the experts didn't see it coming. And they all are comfortable with the fact that it's a total surprise. It's what we love about sports, that you can't predict what's going to happen. It's why we love hockey, especially this time of the year.
Tony Loughman, my guest. Now, Tony, you are the rare guest who can actually bring or will bring visual aids with him. You're also a clone, so you're very familiar with the rules of this show. At the top of that list is the rule that personal appearance is not show fodder. Yet you've been breaking that rule with your comparison between Henry Thomas, the child star of ET, and Winnipeg goalie Connor Hellebuyck. Would you like to explain yourself now that you have the floor?
I would, and I want to apologize because I don't want to stretch the rules. As a loyal fan of the show, I understand that personal appearance is not show fodder. Having said that, I want to qualify by saying there's no bigger fan of the movie E.T. than me. I grew up in the 80s. That was one of the real turning points. It was okay to cry in the movies. That was a big moment. And he is as gifted as Henry Thomas was as Elliot in that movie. Connor Hellebuyck has been extraordinary. Breaking through, he was supposed to be a backup goalie this year. Not only is he the starter, he's an all-star. He has been marvelous for this Jets team that's one win away from advancing to the first conference final in their franchise's history. He's a young guy in his early 20s from Commerce, Michigan, a delightful guy, too. I had the chance to spend time with him at the All-Star break. Really good head on his shoulders and easy guy to root for.
And a guest with visual aids. That's a first. I love that. Tony Loughman, my guest. Now, Tony, I took Nashville for my unstoppable, undefeated Rome NHL pick prior to the postseason, and it made sense, right? They looked unstoppable in the regular season, but they've given up a ton of goals in this series. What has Winnipeg been able to do to make Nashville so uncomfortable?
They've scored at even strength. They've also scored in four straight games on the power play, but it's shocking because in the regular season, Peter Laviolette's team was so stingy. Their back end, obviously, so celebrated. This time of the year, last year, we were talking about that back end, their top four defensively. In this series, it's been a totally different story. Not only have the Jets been able to score, they've scored in bunches. I guess what's most alarming is that they went into Nashville and in Game 5 blew out the Predators, totally took that crowd out of it. Now, after that game, P.K. Subban guaranteed that they'd win this Game 6 and go back there for Game 7. It's hard to question a guy who made a similar guarantee last year in the Cup Final, guaranteed they'd win Game 3, and they did. What's going to happen is they're going to have to defend at even strength more effectively, and Pekka Rinne's got to be really sharp. We've seen him bounce back before. I wouldn't be surprised if he did it again tonight in Winnipeg.
All right, so finish that thought. I mean, Nashville had the best road record in the regular season. Winnipeg had the best home record in the regular season. You started that thought. Ultimately, what does tonight's game come down to?
I think it comes down to who scores first. We know that in the regular season, 70% of the time or so, the team that scores first wins. That building, as you point out, the best home ice advantage in the National Hockey League, if that building gets going, it is going to be wave after wave of emotion. And we've seen, even earlier in this series, just how extraordinary Winnipeg can be. I don't think the noise hurts Nashville, but my goodness, do the Jets feed off of it? Blake Wheeler captured the passion and the tremendous interest in the team and Winnipeg this way. This was in our research packet today. He said that, let's just say I haven't been going to the grocery store very often. That whole place is living for this team. And they're one win away. I think if they score first, I think the Jets beat the Preds.
Yeah, I got to say, I knew coming in this would be tough. I took Nashville, but in no way am I surprised by this. I'm not happy to see it, but I'm not surprised by it. You knew Winnipeg was going to give them all they could handle. Now, tonight, you also have Game 6 in Pittsburgh, where the two-time defending champs are facing elimination. Washington, Tony, blew that two-goal lead in the third period of Game 1, and it seemed like, here we go again, same old Caps, but they've won three of the last four since. What do you make of the way they have bounced back from that loss in Game 1?
It's a remarkable story. Obviously, Alex Ovechkin is at the center of it. Nine times in his 13 seasons they've gone to the playoffs, but they've never gotten beyond the second round. And it's something that really hurts his legacy. Here he is for the seventh time in his career with a chance to advance to a conference final. In the previous six, obviously, he's lost them all. Two of those losses have come against the Penguins, once in 09 and once last year. Here's a guy who realistically is going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer, is the best goal scorer of his generation. He's about 200 goals apart from anybody else that's played during his time, and yet he hasn't found a way to get beyond this round. I think for Ovechkin and for the Caps, it's a story of resilience. They fell behind 2-0 in the first round. You mentioned how they stumbled out of the gates in this series. It's a mentally tougher group. You could make the case that last year's team and the year before that with the President's trophies, that those teams had more talent, more depth, but this year's team has shown a resilience and a mental toughness that's so crucial this time of the year. I wouldn't be surprised if they went into Pittsburgh and beat the Pens in their barn, which would be extraordinary and an incredible way for the two-time defending champs to leave the playoffs.
Yeah, Tony, my sense is it's a different Caps team. They certainly look like a different team. They've got the feel of a different team. I need to see them finish this before I actually say that, but they feel different. Now, there's so much going on in hockey that I haven't had a chance to ask you about Brad Marchand and his licking. Did you ever think that you would come on this show and we would be talking about one player licking another player?
I did not, and it's very unfortunate because when we think about the identity of the Boston Bruins, it's the Big Bad Bruins, original six franchise, tough, fierce, and unfortunately, Brad Marchand is too good a player to be mixed up in this, and he's been on this line and right at the edge for quite some time. The most unfortunate part of this is that he's so good, yet all we're going to talk about is this. And I want to pay tribute to Ryan Callahan, the guy on the other side of that play, the guy who got licked. He was so determined not to give a penalty that what he did was take that and just eventually skate away, because the Bruins, after game two, weren't able to score an even strength goal in that series. That, to me, captures the toughness that playoff hockey brings about. These guys elevate their mental toughness and their physical toughness to a ridiculous level.
And Tony, one follow. I mean, it seems like pretty much everybody is disgusted by the licking except for Marchand himself, who was asked by the league and asked about the league, telling him to stop, and he said, quote, "I think it's pretty stupid. The whole situation, if that's what they want to do, then that's what they want to do," end quote. So put aside what he's doing, what do you make of his response to what he's doing?
It's unfortunate. You know, it reminds me of WWE and the heel behavior of certain wrestlers. It's not just what they do, it's the reaction afterwards, and it drives a crowd into a frenzy. He is such a talented hockey player, and when he first broke in, you understood that he had to be an irritant. That was part of his game. You think back to the Bruins team in 11 that won the Cup. He's deep on the depth chart. He's a depth guy, and this is his game. He's elevated his game beyond this. It's a shame that he doesn't recognize that, one, and two, that he hasn't been more contrite in the aftermath of it. That's the unfortunate thing about it. To his teammates' credit, they've handled it better than he has, and to his coach's credit, Bruce Cassidy, he's handled it well. I hope that Brad Marchand, in this offseason, takes a good, long look at just how special the opportunity he has is. It's a good Boston team. They made progress this year. He's one of their best players, but he's got to avoid this kind of stuff going forward on the ice, and then he's got to not really double down on it off the ice. When he makes a mistake, just admit, hey, I made a mistake. I caught up in the heat of the moment. My mistake, it won't happen again. I hope nothing like this happens again. He's too good, and the league was embarrassed by it. It was a bad moment for everybody.
You can watch Tony Loughman hosting NHL Tonight following tonight's Game 6 between Nashville and Winnipeg. A huge game, needless to say. He's a host there. He's a friend of the program, and he is a clone. My man, Tony Loughman. Tony, great job. Have a great night. Nice to have you back in the jungle. Well done.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to visit with you, Jim. Thanks.
Let's talk some baseball for a minute. Matt Harvey. Well, there's baseball, and then there's Matt Harvey. Matt Harvey's like his own sport. He unto himself is his own sport, designated for assignment. And while it does leave the Mets a couple of different options, the only assignment that the Mets really gave Harvey once he said no to going to the minors was pack your bags, get the hell out of here.
Pack your bags.
Get the hell out of here. Because if you were holding out hope somehow that the Mets and the one-time Prince of Gotham were going to make things work, don't. Because GM Sandy Alderson isn't. Because these do not sound like the words of a guy who wants to make it work. These are the words of a guy with a Marlboro between his teeth, a beer in one hand, and a shovel in the other. Because after hearing this, Alderson did not designate Matt Harvey for assignment. He dug the hole for his body.
End of an era. We've tried to find some other solution over a fairly long period of time. This was a long time coming. You know, this is not someone who hasn't pitched well recently. So, I mean, this is something we've tried to address, we've struggled with, we've wrestled with over two managerial regimes. The move to the bullpen was dramatic in itself. So I think that, you know, at this point, pragmatism, realism far outweighed other considerations.
Somebody's got to tell this guy that it's not kind to speak ill of the dead. Somebody keep Alderson away from the mic at a funeral, because that was not designating somebody for assignment. That was sending somebody to the afterlife. And as great as it all started for Harvey, it ends even worse for the team and for him. And how and where did this all go so wrong? How and where did it go all so wrong for a guy who used to run the most important city in the world? How? When? Right around the time he blew out his elbow. I mean, sure, this guy's a mess between his ears. But that was not a problem until his elbow exploded. Before that, he was just the savior that that city and that team needed. And he wanted to be that guy. And he reveled in that role. But there's more to getting big league hitters out than throwing on your Batman mask. And the fact is, he no longer intimidates anybody, no longer fools anybody, slinging the puss that he's currently slinging. And that cat's gone. That cat's gone now from the Mets, because that cat's no longer any good. Nor would he or could he reinvent himself. And because he was not willing to accept who he is and what he's become, the Mets had no choice but to break him off. I mean, Dark Knight. This guy's like the Penguin at this point. The Penguin. More importantly than a bad pun, the guy just is not self-aware at all. The guy couldn't be lying to himself any more than he is. Since 2015, his fastball velo has fallen off a cliff. His average fastball has gone from nearly 97 to a tick above 92. From really, really good to really, really average. And apparently the only guy unaware of that fact is Matt Harvey, because he's throwing more fastballs than ever before, despite the fact that it's coming out of his hand slower than ever before. Listen, this isn't even necessarily about his act off the field. I mean, in part. But nobody cares if you're in page six every week, if you strike out 10 and take the ball every week. But if you're getting lit on fire in mop-up innings and driving nearly 300 miles round trip just to run into a cocktail, then it's pretty easy to understand why the Mets are happy to see this guy hit the bricks and why they've given up on him, especially after Harvey is not willing to go down to the farm to try to figure things out. And if Mickey Callaway can't fix you, I'm not sure you are fixable. So while the Mets still have a shot in making some noise in the East, they were right to rid themselves of a gigantic distraction. That kind of distraction is worth it as long as the guy's producing. But when he's throwing BP fastballs from the bullpen, then it's time to say goodbye. Because Gotham needs a new hero. One without a broken right arm and a 10% head. And while somebody else might be able to fix this guy, and never mind that ever happening until the guy's willing to put in the time to fix himself, this much is certain. It was not going to happen in New York. That was busted. That was irreparable. So good news, Matt. The checks, still cash. And plenty of time for you to hit the Hamptons now that you are unemployed. I said it last week before they did it. It's time. It's time. And now he's done.
Now I'm done.
Notre Dame head coach Brian Kelly is my guest. Brian, great to have you back on. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me on the show.
Always good to talk to you, Brian. Thanks so much. Let me start first with this. I had 49ers GM John Lynch on last week, and he was clearly thrilled, Brian, to have the chance to take your former left tackle Mike McGlinchey with the 9th pick overall. So what kind of a player and person are the 49ers getting in McGlinchey?
Well, you know, I was fortunate enough to coach Joe Staley, their all-pro left tackle as well, and one of the things that separated many of the players that I have is their impact in the locker room, not only on the field. That's unmistakable. Long, athletic tackle. But he was a two-time captain for me. And to have him with a Joe Staley, two great character guys, I think it just increases, obviously, the kind of culture that they're building at San Francisco, men of high character.
We're talking to Notre Dame head football coach Brian Kelly. Speaking of men of high character, Lynch, along with just about every other draft analyst that I've had on this show, also raved about Quentin Nelson, who went to Indy with the sixth pick. And the thing that kept coming up regarding Nelson was not just his technique or his skill, but his attitude. How would you describe that attitude, and how valuable is that in an offensive lineman?
Well, I think it's a great question that many great players, Hall of Famers, can answer, and that is, he had a mindset that when he played, he wanted to dominate his opponent. It wasn't just good enough to be a good player. He wanted to dominate in everything that he did, whether it was in the classroom, it was on our football practice field, and in games. So I just think that the great players, and when we talk about the great ones of all time, they have that dominant mindset, and Quentin Nelson has that.
Brian Kelly, my guest. So, Brian, what's it like as head coach to see your players get drafted and get to take the next step in their lives as both players and men?
Well, look, at Notre Dame, it's pretty clear that, you know, we're in it to, our mission is to graduate all of our players and to develop them holistically so they're good fathers, good husbands, great people to be around, give back to the community. And so, for us at Notre Dame, you know, our mission is that. And, you know, again, I don't know that you're shopping down a different aisle when you chose Notre Dame. And what that is essentially is that we're developing, you know, future great men in the community. And that's why it's an honor and a privilege to be the head coach.
Notre Dame head football coach Brian Kelly, my guest. Now, you made a lot of changes going into last season, both in terms of the staff and your personal approach. Then you go out and you compete for a playoff spot in November. You win 10 games, including a bowl win over LSU. So how pleased were you with the way everybody in the program responded to a really challenging 2016 season?
Well, you know, for me, being at it 27 years, you know, I think the accountability piece starts with me. And so I was pleased in the sense that we were all able to achieve many of the goals. We didn't get our number one goal, and that is to win a championship. But we put ourselves back in a position now that we can compete for championships, and that should be part of our mission. So I'm pleased from that perspective that we've got it in the right position for us to compete for championships year in and year out.
Still, you started that response by talking about personal accountability. You and I talked about this a little bit during the season, but I feel like it's something that does bear repeating. You've been very, very successful. You have more than 200 career wins. You've been the National Coach of the Year in two different seasons. After 2016, it would have been very easy to say, what we're doing does work, there's no need to change up, but you were willing to analyze yourself in a way that a lot of coaches wouldn't have. Why was that?
Well, I think leadership requires humility as well. And, you know, I think any time that if it's a business or an operation and it's not going the right way, it's easy to point fingers. That's what, you know, obviously many people choose to do. I think great leadership starts with accountability at the top. And so I had to look at what I was doing on a day-to-day basis, and the shortcomings that I had led to a number of the defeats that we had. I didn't prepare our football team the right way. They lost close games, and it's not because they didn't want to win. They didn't know how to win, and that falls on my shoulders. So, again, I think the best way to put it, Jim, is that I think to have effective leaders, there has to be that accountability at the top.
Notre Dame head football coach Brian Kelly joins us. You've got a big night tonight, which I'm going to get to in 1 minute. Before I go there, let me ask you about your quarterback situation, Brian. Brandon Wimbush had a lot of great moments last season and struggled at times. Ian Book also played at times and had success. So I'm curious, going into spring practice, there was a question as to how you might handle the quarterback situation this season. What do you make of how both players showed up this spring?
Well, you're absolutely right in that, you know, at the end of the season, we needed both last year. We needed both Brandon and Ian to have the success that we had, and in particular the LSU game. Brandon was replaced by Ian in that game. So the spring was really a proving ground for Brandon and Ian, and I thought they both were outstanding. I think Brandon brings a lot to the table if he's a more effective passer, because we know about his ability to run. He showed this spring that he's ready to take the next step in terms of accuracy, in terms of mechanics, and playing the position at the level that we need you to play at if you're a quarterback at Notre Dame. So really pleased with Ian as well, but I think Brandon's put himself in a position, if he continues to do what he did in the spring through preseason camp, you know, we're going to be in great shape come the fall.
Well, and then you start the season off with Michigan coming to South Bend. You have never been afraid of opening the season with a tough opponent. How much does that help focus everybody the entire offseason when you know you've got Michigan right out of the gate?
Oh, yeah. It certainly is a challenge playing the Michigan team. Coach Harbaugh will have his team ready, there's no doubt. But it does help us. You're right. I mean, we know what to expect. We're going to be challenged right out of the gate. So our preseason has to be outstanding. Our offseason has to be, top-notch. And so it gets everybody's attention.
Right, so I mentioned a big night tonight. Your foundation, the Kelly Cares Foundation, is having its Irish Eyes Gala, where you are going to honor David Robinson, Brady Quinn, and the family of Ara Parseghian. Ara passed away last August, Brian, at the age of 94, and was an absolute icon and legend as a coach. And in retirement, he used to write to you after every single game. What were those letters like, and what did they mean to you?
Well, they were special in the sense that, I consider him obviously an incredible mentor and an icon at Notre Dame. And so just to get early on in my career the kind of support and more than anything else, the notes were handwritten. And, you know, today we get caught up with social media and Instagram and Twitter, and it loses that personal touch. And for him to take the time, you know, to handwrite a note, and they weren't long, but they were to the point, and they were always looking at something positive moving forward. So those will always be part of my memories with regard to Aaron Parseghian.
And while you're not looking to make this about you, I'll go ahead and make it about you for a moment, because the foundation that you and your wife started back in 2008 has contributed more than $4.2 million to a number of causes locally and nationally and internationally. $4.2 million is a huge number. What does the number mean to you?
It means that we're blessed. My wife and I, she beat cancer twice, I'm the one that had it easy, if you will. And so we said we're gonna make sure that we're gonna give back because we're so blessed to be where we are today. And so again, I think today, you know, we gave 10,000 books out to the Archdiocese schools here in New York. It's just when you're able to be in a position of change, we wanted to do something about it. And the Kelly Cares Foundation has been that vehicle for us.
The Kelly Cares Foundation is hosting that gala tonight at the Pierre Hotel. It is in Manhattan. Head football coach Notre Dame, Brian Kelly, my guest. Great cause, Brian. Congrats to you and your family. Always nice to have you on the show. Thank you so much, and have a great night.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure.
Rex in Albuquerque. First call of the week. Rex, what's going on?
Hey, Jim. To be honest, you know, I'm a little angry. This New Jersey school superintendent is trying to appropriate my brand by going to the running track at the local high school and dropping smellies. But speaking of smellies, I don't know if you're up to Periscope very much, but we were graced with three videos of Cal in Vegas playing golf. I don't know where this cat was playing, but it definitely wasn't Shadow Creek. The course looked like it had contracted a scorching case of herpes. Just dead tufts of grass everywhere. The wind was gusting out of the northwest at about 65 miles an hour, and Cal had his sweaty Bridgestone hat on lock. You know, it may come as a shock, but Cal isn't as dapper and refined as you might think. Don't think I didn't notice the black shoe, white ankle sock combination, Cal. I'm guessing you're not using Rome Stylus. And as sweet as those double-pleated Dockers with frayed cuffs were, they don't hold a candle to the baggy Pat Reed polo with sleeves down to the wrists you were wearing. Jim always says you're worth whatever someone is willing to pay you. And Cal, you're worth every penny of the $8 an hour the Thunder from Down Under is paying you to change out their urinal cakes. Just enough to cover your low T injections, your chest waxes, and an occasional visit to the buffet at the Hard Rock. Just be careful. They had to take down the sneeze guard, so nobody knows what's really marinating in that chicken casserole. War the pod. I'm out.
All right, Rex. You got to the end of the phone call without getting run, but I can't rack a call when it's all about personal appearance. Personal appearance is not show fodder. Your entire call was about how the guy looks. So that's not going to work. However, your delivery, as always, was perfect.
Good night,